Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Busy, busy program today. Up first will be Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor. We'll get his take on the gubernatorial debate last night between Sue Minter and Phil Scott. And then Daphne Larkin, assistant director of communications at Norwich University, a very large incoming freshman class this year. Who are they and how did they do it? And then Talk Media News, Bob Ney, and we'll get a lot in about national politics during that segment. And lastly, Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. We're going to be talking about polling. How do they do it? And some recent results on polls, plus a lot of time to take your phone calls. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255 during today's program. But first up, it's my pleasure to introduce Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor. Good morning, Paul. Paul? Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mike, sorry about that. I had you on mute. Pouring myself another cup of coffee. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for joining us this morning. We saw the first debate last night between Sue Minter and Phil Scott. Anything, did we glean anything out of that debate?
Well, it's nice to be in the general election here where you have two candidates on stage and they have some fairly significant differences in on the issues and approach and style. You know, I think my biggest takeaway from the debate is not a surprising one, but you've got these two fundamentally different candidates. Sue Minter, who is she's a little bit wonkier. She's focused on issues. She has a policy program to deal with many different problems she sees in Vermont, and she's happy to tell you about what that is. And you've got Phil Scott, who's answer to most questions is kind of the same, which is we need to do less, we need to make Vermont more affordable. And, you know, I think in some ways Phil Scott is in an enviable place because his message is very simple, it's crisp. You know, you kind of know where he stands when you walk away from a debate like this. Sometimes it sounds like he's just saying the same thing over and over again, but if you want that message to resonate, I suppose it works. Whereas you know, with Sue Minter, she may appear more prepared, but the answer always seems to be more government intervention.
And that's where I was sort of going to follow up, Paul. What was interesting on some of the positions, Sue Minter seemed to be saying, last night at least, that cuts are not the way to do it. But most Vermonters really see state spending as a significant issue, and she does roll out these plans, but those plans cost money. And then on the other side, you have Scott, who says he supports those who determine what bathrooms they want to use in terms of transgender sex or how they identify as sex, and that must peeve off his base. So my question is this: Are they bucking the trends because most Vermonters want to see some sort, according to polls, and those are the Castleton Institute polls, want to see some constraint in state spending, and yet Sue Minter says doesn't seem to be headed in that direction. And you have Phil Scott's base probably peeved off with his position on transgender bathrooms, yet does he need them for the general election?
Well, let me get back to the transgender question in a second, but first let me focus spending side. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. If you ask people, do they want to spend more or less money on state government? Yeah, they want to spend less money on state government, no doubt about it. But when you start looking at what specifically people want to see cut, that's when it gets a little bit trickier. And I think, you see that tension every legislative session. Nobody wants to raise revenue. But as soon as legislators talk about cutting program X, Y, or Z, I think people get upset about that as well. And so that debate will play out in this election. I thought something that really kind of surprised me, at least on sort of the spending side of the equation, was that Phil Scott wasn't really able to articulate any specific cuts that he would want to see to the state budget. Pete Hirschfeld from VPR asked a pretty open-ended question to him near the start of the debate. Essentially, can you identify a few line items from any recent budget, I think is how he put it. And Phil Scott really kind of weaved around that question. It should be a layup for him. You know, I mean, if you're a Republican running for governor of Vermont, you should have a list of 3 to 5 specific budget cuts at the ready that you would make. And he couldn't really answer that question. So that kind of surprised me a little bit. He wouldn't have those specifics nailed down. Now, in terms of the transgender question, you know, that was definitely a very interesting part of the debate because it was a very sort of Vermont Republican answer. You know, Phil Scott is not someone who is a conservative on social issues. You see that with abortion. You see that with same-sex marriage. You see that now with transgender rights. And, you know, he clearly recognizes the peril in sort of raising the ire of the left on social issues, and so he's trying to steer clear of any kind of controversy in that realm. He wants to stick to economic issues, where I think it's fair to say Vermonters are more moderate, and so, you know, I think that was probably a savvy move, even if it does piss off some more right of center voters in the state.
One of the things that I noticed in the debate, that they kept talking about finding efficiencies to pay for things in state government. And when Matt Dunn was in here during the primaries, one of his programs was to pay for special ed through efficiencies in the Department of Education. And when I pushed him on those efficiencies, he couldn't list the efficiencies.
Right, because no politician ever can, right? I mean, the word efficiency is such a red herring in the political discourse. And it's the same as when you hear the words waste, fraud, abuse.
Yeah.
Those are just words that you say when you cannot talk specifics. You know, I mean, do you think that Jim Douglas didn't look for efficiencies for waste, fraud, abuse? Do you think Peter Shumlin did? No, I mean, it's ridiculous.
And that was the point I was going to make. These two have been in government, so why didn't they look at efficiencies while they were there?
Yeah, and I'm sure they did, and I'm sure that, you know, everyone looks for efficiencies. Efficiencies are what you do, but that's not, you know, that's not an actual solution to a problem, and that's not, you can't bank on savings from efficiencies. I think that's, you know, Democrat or Republican, when you hear that answer, you're not really getting the straight story.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how do you rate the performance of Sue Minter first and then Phil Scott?
You know, I don't know that I'd be able to rate either of them on a scale from 1 to 10. You know, I think... They're both getting better at debating. There were times when both were a little bit low energy, to use a Donald Trumpism. But I thought they were fine. You know, I didn't see really any major blunders. You know, I didn't see any knockout punches. They both, I think, presented their arguments fairly well, and things will get feistier as the election moves along. It's an early debate, so it's not surprising to me that they kept it pretty civil. I thought the discussion about climate change was an interesting one towards the end, and I'm hoping to write about that a little bit more in my column tomorrow. But this is an area where Phil Scott actually has shifted a bit. And in fact, you asked him about it on your program earlier this summer,
mm-hmm.
And he gave a bit of a different answer than he did last night. In his previous answers, he's been sort of more inclined to say that climate change is caused, could be caused by humans, but also natural phenomena may play some role in that. And he's framed it a couple of different ways. I forget which way he put it on your program. But he's gotten some pushback on that from those who point out that there's really no dispute in the scientific community that climate change is caused by humans. And he seemed to have rejiggered his answer last night, and it was much more clear that he thinks humans cause climate change. So that was probably the smart thing to do now. Was it too late? Hard to say. I mean, I do think that you'll see Democrats hammering him on what they perceive as a flip-flop on that issue.
Paul Hines, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Happy to do it.
That's Paul Hines from 7 Days. And I do want to take a few moments to talk about the upcoming debates between the candidates for governor, between Phil Scott and Sue Minter. As you know, WDEV has a very, very rich tradition of holding debates for governor at the Tunbridge Fair in September. It is a wonderful setting. It is a gorgeous setting at the Tunbridge Fair. And those debates have been pretty good in the past. And this year I was looking forward to it because the overall feedback that I've gotten from our audience, at least in the primary season, is that I asked tough questions, that I got quickly to pertinent points that had depth and heft. But I also was fair in how I asked the questions. So I appreciate all your feedback. But this year, I contacted the campaigns of both Phil Scott and Sue Minter shortly, and it must have been a day or two shortly after the primary their primary victories, regarding their willingness to participate in this year's Tunbridge Fair debate. And what I expected was a simple yes. But I must say, from the response I'm getting, I'm a little worried that this debate may not happen, and it may not go forward as planned. First off, the campaign of Sue Minter never got back to us, and I understand they're busy, but they should get back to people asking about debates. Phil Scott's campaign, especially, by the way, especially WDEV, who has been sort of the hometown radio station of both of these candidates. Phil Scott's campaign got back to us rather quickly, but added conditions to Phil Scott participating, and conditions that I quickly rejected for the reasons I just want to take some time to explain to you so you know. Phil Scott's campaign insists that Bill Lee, who is running on the Liberty Union ticket, also participate in the debate with Sue Minter. Believe me, having Bill Lee on stage with the two main candidates, it would be a ratings boost for this program. It would be a popular debate. I understand it. It would be entertaining. It would garner a lot of attention, maybe even national attention, maybe even late-night talk TV if we did that. But I rejected that condition because Vermont is faced with enormous challenges. Challenges the next governor is going to have to face. You know, I read a heart-wrenching letter, I think it was in VT Digger the other day, that from a gentleman who talked about his struggles of living in this state. And that hit home to me. That letter really hit home to me. The next governor needs to do something about this, needs to do something about jobs, the economy, the number one issue with Vermonters. These are serious times for Vermont that need serious, well-thought-out solutions. Bill Lee is not going to be our next governor. It will be either Sue Minter or Phil Scott. So at a debate when Vermont is desperately in search of serious solutions, one-third of the debate time will be diverted on a candidate that may garner only 10% of the vote if I agree to the Scott campaign rules. One-third time less to focus on two candidates, one of which will be governor, as I said, and one-third time less to understand their solutions for these very serious issues we face as a state. Don't get me wrong, I like Phil Scott. He's a decent and honest guy, but I think his campaign team is steering him wrong in this direction for three reasons. First, they insist they are doing this because it's the Democratic thing to do. But it hurts their candidate because it looks like they're ducking taking on Sue Minter one-on-one. No one will believe this is philosophical. That's what the Scott campaign team claims. They will believe, as I do, that this is tactical, trying to limit the exposure of their candidate in a debate form. Maybe Sue Minter is slicker than Scott in debating skills, or maybe not. But believe me, believe me when I say this, Vermonters aren't looking for slick. They've got all the slick they wanted in the last 6 years. What they want is an honest discussion about how these two candidates are going to quell the economic angst that most Vermonters are feeling. They want compassion, and they want to hear and see it shown by the candidates that they understand Vermonters' plight. But most of all, they want real solutions. Second, and this is to the Scott campaign team, it's not consistent with what the Scott campaign is doing throughout the debate schedule, or even with their own rules. Phil Scott is debating Sue Minter one-on-one in some debates, as in last night's debate, but demanding in our WDEV debate that it be done in another way. There is a fundamental inconsistency with that position. And if democracy is all important, then why, if that's the reason why you want Bill Lee in the debates, then why have a limit on the total number of debates? The Scott campaign has put a limit on the debates. Debate every night. If democracy is your number one issue, debate every night. I think we'd get a little tired of that, but, you know, let's be consistent with the position. Third, putting restrictions on the debate doesn't usually work well for the candidate demanding the restrictions. Jim Jeffords tried it against Jan Backus by insisting that she wanted one-on-one debates. He wanted everybody included. Backus claimed Jeffords was ducking her and had great impact with voters until Jan Backus made a major policy mistake toward the end of her campaign, resulting in Jeffords having a pretty easy, I think it was a 10-point re-election victory. Donald Trump made demands that were routinely ignored as well. And I've been critical of politicians in the past, mostly with federal incumbents that duck debates either by insisting multiple candidates be there or by limiting the number of debates to ridiculous few numbers of debates. I know that Phil Scott's campaign, as well as the Minter campaign, have the right to put any restrictions they desire on how and when they wish to debate. I'm not arguing that. In a democracy, that is their right. Debates aren't required, but boy, are they so needed in these times in Vermont. But it's also our right to choose to reject those conditions, and I have done so for the reasons that I cited. And again, this isn't entirely on Phil Scott. We never did hear back from the Sue Minter campaign, which I thought, again, was unfortunate given that WDEV has been the hometown radio station of both campaigns. Look, I'll continue to try to pursue this debate, because foregoing this governor's debate is unfortunate, because I felt the questions I would ask would be pertinent to understanding how the candidates will address the fundamental problems facing the state. I'm not a special interest group, but rather, I'm just like most Vermonters, worried about the future of this state. And if we have to, and I hope we don't have to, but if we have to, we'll turn our attention to the major lieutenant governor candidates and schedule them up for the debate instead, which we're going to do anyways. We'll just do it on a different day. We'll schedule them up. And maybe we'll do some local House races that usually get scant attention but have a major hand in crafting the future of this state. Those reps, those senators have major say into what will be the future of this state. I'll continue to give you updates on this debate, but I did want to give you an update of where we are right now. I hope we can settle this issue, but right now we're at loggerheads with both campaigns, actually. and I will continue to keep you updated as warranted. Coming up, Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University. We're going to talk to her about why the large incoming freshman class. Where did they come from? How did they do it? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in studio, in our WDEV studios with us today, is Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University. And for those out there who email me, because sometimes I say Norwich College, I'm over that. It's Norwich University. I've gone past that. I grew up saying that, and that was my problem. Good morning, Daphne.
Good morning, Mike.
Daphne, the size of the incoming 2020 class is surprising, at least to me. It's large. And what can you tell us about the class, how many are coming, where they're coming from? Other details.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me today, by the way. We have about 900 students coming into the class of 2020. On Sunday, we welcomed 600 rooks. That's first-year students in the Corps of Cadets. That's going to make for a regiment of 1,600, the largest ever at Norwich University. And then we have another 300 students, civilian students, arriving on Wednesday.
And where are they coming? Where are you drawing from these, this incoming class?
Well, primarily New England states, and then Florida, Texas, and California. So we recruit in areas that have vibrant JROTC programs, so students who are looking for an ROTC experience or to continue that kind of structured lifestyle, or who want that kind of military culture. Maybe they grew up in a military family. They're coming for the academics, for the athletics, and for the Corps of Cadets, of course.
And details about the class, SAT scores, average SAT scores, majors, what can you tell us about this class? Are they really interested in what kind of profession?
You know, Norwich University was founded almost 200 years ago on this idea by Alden Partridge, that he felt it was very important to educate students to both build and defend the Republic. And we're still doing that today. We were the first private institution to teach engineering, so other than West Point, which is a federal academy, right? So our engineering programs are really strong. Mechanical engineering and civil engineering are still attracting some of the highest numbers in our incoming classes. Beyond that, cybersecurity, not surprising, right, which of course did not exist 200 years ago, but now it does because we need it to both build and defend our republic. Criminal justice, we have the largest program around. So that's also one of our largest attracting programs. So, you know, these are students who are really focused. They know what they want. They want to serve the community. And they're attracted to our four-year progressive leadership model, which exists in our academics and also in our student life in the Corps of Cadets and in athletics. We teach ethics in every program that we do. We talk about it every day. So it's the quality of student that we're attracting is getting higher with every year. So it's not like we're bringing in all these numbers because we're accepting everybody. That's not true. We have like a 60% acceptance rate now, which is really different from the 90s.
And when I looked at the average SAT scores, it was pretty impressive what candidates you're getting, or candidates, students you're getting to your university. It's quite a an intellectual group, I would say.
Yes, these are high achievers. Yeah. These are 18-year-olds who want structure. That's a pretty special student who is looking for such an incredible challenge.
This is a large class, and whereas other institutions are struggling, why have you had such success?
Well, you know, I mean, again, all of the things that I've talked about are our academic programs. It's also our setting. When students come to visit Norwich University, they just fall in love with the place. You know, Vermont is just so gorgeous. You were just talking about that, right? We love being here. It's a gorgeous setting. Our campus is just getting more and more beautiful with the transformation that it's undergoing. But it's also the small class sizes. We have about a 14 or 15 to 1 student to faculty ratio. Our faculty are dedicated to mentoring students. We have an important culture of undergraduate research, which doesn't exist in most places. So our undergraduate students actually get treated like graduate students. They have the opportunity to pursue summer fellowships where they get paid to do research, and they produce original research. We have students who are earning patents, who are earning national awards for their research. And I think that we really stand out. And like I said, the students are looking for something initially, and then they come to Norwich and they realize the combination of our strong College of Liberal Arts foundation, along with these building, you know, constructing and the emphasis on sustainable development in our architecture and engineering and construction management programs and service through nursing and everything else that we do is just the right combination. It's what students today want.
Most people, when they think of Norwich, they think of a military institution and instilling those sort of skills in order to move on into a military career. But it's more than that. There are civilian courses as well. When people come, when freshmen come to Norwich College, let's start with what do they do before classes, both in the military aspect of it and in, did I say Norwich University? Everybody's looking at me, and I grew up saying this, and it's got to get off of my mind.
Well, maybe this will help. I'll tell you something, right? Norwich University changed recently, maybe about 5 years ago now. We changed the structure, so we're actually five colleges one university.
And I was talking about that college.
Yeah, that one.
That one college.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about Norwich University. You have these different student bodies, the military student body, the incoming freshmen, you call them rooks, that are coming in. What experience will they have now that you had the ceremony the other day? What happens before classes start?
So they arrived on Sunday with their families. It's a wonderful day. 600 students. If you go to our Facebook or Twitter accounts, you'll see that President Schneider took a selfie with the 600 rooks.
Three of them.
Well, it was several. That's right. Yeah, because he had to get the whole room. Okay. But this is Rook Orientation Week. So what they do is as soon as they say goodbye to their parents on Sunday, they are marched, you know, formed into their companies for the first time, marched up to the upper parade ground, change into their PT gear. They meet their cadre, and they're assessed on their physical standards. So where are they starting from? And they start to learn. This week, they're learning how to do proper sit-ups. They're learning how to salute. They're learning how to march. They're learning how to square their corners. They're learning that they have to walk in the gutters. They're getting familiar with their rook books. It's the cadet handbook. It's a thick book full of a lot of information that they have to memorize, and they have to be able to answer questions on command. They're learning how to be members of the Corps of Cadet this week, and then that will culminate on Sunday with the Dog River Run, which is an old tradition where they run through the river. And then it's an oath ceremony with the civilian students also. So civilian students arrive on Wednesday, and they have their orientation as well. It's just not as rigorous because they don't have to learn how to salute and how to march and those kinds of things. But on Sunday, it's a joint oath ceremony where all the students take the Norwich oath to be ethical students.
What is the difference between the civilian students and the military students in terms of courses they have to take?
The only difference is that if you're in the Corps of Cadets, you have to complete six semesters of ROTC classes in order to earn what's called the Military College of Vermont diploma when they graduate. If you're commissioning, you have to do eight semesters of ROTC. But that's about half of the Corps or less will commission. So the academics themselves are not different. We do have programs that came from Vermont College, the civilian college, and moved over, like nursing and architecture. And so the faculty don't have to wear uniforms. That's the only distinction. But in the classrooms, you have Corps and civilian students together all the time, except for ROTC.
We're speaking with Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University. If you wish to join our conversation, and I get it, I said Norwich College, it's Norwich University, so you don't have to call and remind me that I screwed up on that. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's turn to some of the robust programs that you have, because we've been talking a little bit about the military, but you have a very robust programs in what I would call the professional fields: engineering, nursing, accounting. Not too many people know about those.
Well, I'm doing my best, Mike. Come on now. That's what I'm here for, right?
So let's talk about those programs.
Okay. All right. Yeah, great. So like I said, you know, we're like the first to teach engineering. Our David Crawford School of Engineering is a fabulous place. We have incredible faculty there. I'm thinking of Professor Tara Cole Carney, who is a civil engineer who's focusing on water issues. And she's done research with a student where they created porous concrete for parking lots to reduce runoff from rain, which absorbs the rain and filters it on the way down so that it's clean on the way out. So these are the kinds of problems that are getting solved at Norwich. We also have faculty in engineering who are working with students to design and invent assistive technologies. So fretless guitars, a glove that teaches sign language, those kinds of things. So, yeah.
When we're speaking with Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University, if you wish to join our conversation, 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, Norwich has made national news, and I want to ask Daphne about that. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to be talking to, in this half hour, Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University. And what we're talking about, what we started talking about, was the incoming freshman class and how large they are. 900 freshman students coming in, 600 on the Corps cadet side, 300 civilian side. And when you put the Corps of Cadets together, 1,600 Corps of Cadets, largest ever.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Let's turn to something that made national news. Saw it in the Washington Post, saw it throughout the country in various news outlets, that Norwich was in the news for granting a request from where a Muslim student, a woman, had requested an exemption from the regular military uniform. And the Citadel had rejected that request. Norwich granted the request. Why?
Well, let me just make a slight correction here on semantics. Norwich University granted a request to accommodate the Norwich University Corps of Cadets uniform. That's not the military. That's the Corps of Cadets.
Right.
It's a technicality, but that is our purview. We have purview over our uniform.
Right, as does the Citadel, right?
Correct. So why did we grant this accommodation? It's the right thing to do is the short answer. You know, we have been accommodating religious attire unofficially, I think, for a long time, yarmulkes and crosses and that sort of thing. What was different about this is the hijab request is a headscarf and covering of the arms and legs. So it's just materials that don't exist necessarily within the uniform itself. So it needed to become codified. And so this was just our first opportunity to address that.
Has any other military institution adopted your dress code, I guess it would be called? Uniform code.
Well, I don't know about that, but I can tell you that we're not the first military college to grant this kind of request. I think it was Texas A&M and their Corps of Cadets has already done this. And then there's another institution that I think it's the Virginia Military Women's Institution who has done this as well. They're not one of the six senior military colleges or Federal Service Academy, but it is a precedent. As well as the Department of Defense, their policy is to, you know, work with these accommodations as they come up. So it's really just the natural thing to do. This is what our military looks like.
Let's turn to some of the things that you're noted for, both, and this is nationally and internationally to some degree, is cybersecurity. Now, did you get to travel to the Super Bowl and see cybersecurity in action?
I did. I actually got to walk around the perimeter of the field the night before the game.
And that's because Norwich University was invited to the Super Bowl.
We were the only university or college or, you know, non-federal agency invited to be part of the security apparatus that covered the Super Bowl, Super Bowl 50.
Mm-hmm. So your program in cybersecurity, what is it?
Well, we have undergraduate programs. We have a graduate program as well. We also have, cutting edge national research happening in our research institutes. So it's really the full breadth of cybersecurity of that topic. And in fact, I'm in the Master's in International Relations program now, and my focus is on cyber policy because of all of this. So, it's in a lot of what we do. We were one of the first to be designated as a center of academic excellence by Homeland Security. Early on, we were certainly the smallest at that time. We have a double accreditation at this point now. We're also accredited for digital forensics, which is a current and evolving field, which people are probably familiar with in crime shows and stuff, where we just have so many devices, you have to know how to do forensics on them.
Well, according to the crime shows, you can solve anything with those devices.
Yeah, and DNA.
Let me ask this question. What did you do at the Super Bowl?
It was 5 students, 1 professor, and myself. And then it was over 60 students on campus working in our cyber war room, processing all of the data that was brought in from the stadium. So we had devices. We partnered with numerous cybersecurity companies who donated their devices. We put them on the system. The stadium out in California, Levi Stadium, was about a year old when we got out there. So it was kind of talked about as being the most technologically capable stadium. People can order jerseys from their seat. You know, there's 70 Wi-Fi hotspots and 70,000 people there. So, there's cyber is in everything. It's in the ticket sales. It's in how everybody's using their devices. It's also, the NFL is using the devices. There's the Jumbotron. It's everywhere. So what we did was we went out there. We lived out there for 10 days in a house and went out ahead of time because, as you can imagine, security at a Super Bowl, it's what's called a SEER 1 event. That's an acronym, Special Event Assessment Rating. I think the only thing more secure than the Super Bowl is the Pope visit. And so what that means is that it activates federal agencies into the security environment. So you have local law enforcement working with federal. So it was really interesting. At the stadium, you had all of the federal agencies with their signs, designating where their spots were. And then you had Norwich Cyber. We got to meet Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson. He came in to that room one day and met everybody around the room and said, who are you and what do you do? And that sort of thing. And he got to us and they said, Norwich University, cybersecurity. And he stopped and he asked questions. What are you doing? We were the only people who he asked questions from. It was so interesting. So that was that setting. But basically for 10 days, we all went to work every day. We spread out into 3 different locations because the security environment is spread out. They don't, have it just in one place. And each had our roles and our jobs.
Did you get to see the game?
Only on TV. No, I wasn't at the stadium for the game. I was in the JIC, the Joint Information Center, so I was with all the other PAOs, which was really fun.
You have recently announced an exchange program with South Korea. Can you just tell us what that's about?
Yeah, sure. We are welcoming our first two Korean cadets to campus for this semester. And apparently, up until now, the country of Korea did not allow for an entire semester exchange. They would do other smaller exchanges, but this is the first semester-long exchange just because the law changed there, and we have relationships there. So they're coming, and our students will be going at some point, maybe as early as this spring.
And international students, are they an important part of your recruiting effort? I noticed that Norwich is hosting a meeting on bringing international students to the campus. What's the purpose of the meeting?
The purpose of the meeting is it's a statewide initiative to attract more international students to colleges and universities and other high schools as well to the state, just to internationalize the state in general. But Norwich has been welcoming international students since the very beginning. And typically we have about 70 international students on campus and 70 Norwich students studying abroad every semester, including the summer.
We're speaking with Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications at Norwich University. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777. Got about 7 minutes left. I'll try to get some of these phone calls in, Tom, or toll free at 877-291-8255. If you want to call quick. Let's go to Berlin. You're on open mic with Daphne Larkin.
Hey, great. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
All right, this is Jerry. Really quick. I'm Norwich family.
Welcome. Nice to hear from you.
That's all I have to say. It's my my father's on the wall, graduated 51. There's nieces, nephews, uncles, whatever, including myself.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you for the phone call. Fred from Moncton Ridge. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
I'm just wondering... Let me turn on radio again. If all the cadets are going to get all the good Donald Trump vetting over there, I would like to know every cadet's name and number before they get to apply there or when they apply there, and I want to make sure every one of those GD candidates is vetted exactly the way Trump is going to vet every one of the people that are going to come into our country.
Thanks, Fred. Look, that's confidential information for most cadets, and I thank you, Fred, for your political statement, but I'm not going to ask Daphne that question. What I am going to ask her, though, is you have some upcoming events that you want to talk about?
We have our Todd Lecture Series program, which is a series of free lectures. We have Marilyn Tam coming up. She's an entrepreneur, an author of The Happiness Choice. That's November 7th at 7 p.m. She's the former CEO of Aveda Corporation. And we have all kinds of programs coming up. We have a new exhibit opening up at the Sullivan Museum on commemorating World War I and World War II. We have our Colby Military Writers Symposium coming up in April, which is going to be fantastic as usual. We have our annual Writers Series coming up. We have typically an architecture and art lecture series as well. I think that is at least some of the public offerings that we have. So check our website.
One of the things that sort of is inspiring, and it happens at sunrise, and it probably happens at sunset too, but I've been there at sunrise, is the forming of the core in the morning. And mm-hmm. It's awe-inspiring to watch these young people sort of gather at the field around the where the dorms are and form the core.
How can people experience this sort of the core aspect of your university?
Yeah, well, it's true. Every morning we do raise the colors, and there's formation of the whole Corps of Cadets. But you don't have to come out that early to see a Corps of Cadets parade. and especially this year with it being so large, with there being 1,600 students in the Corps of Cadets, the parades are they're very moving, and who doesn't love a parade, right? So we want to make sure that the public knows that they're welcome to come and view one of our parades. We're going to have our oath ceremony August 28th at 1:30. And that's on the upper parade ground. And as you describe it, it's the barracks that are that surround it. We have civilian dorms that we built recently, too. So it's the barracks that are around the upper parade. We participate in the Labor Day parade in Northfield. I think it's the largest in the state. We have, you know, review. We have homecoming parade, alumni parade, parent weekend. A big one that I would love for the public to attend is Veterans Day observance. It's not on Veterans Day, but it's the week of Veterans Day, so it's November 11th at 3:00. Please come out to the Veterans Day Parade. It's very moving. We always get great speakers.
And one of the things I want to end this. We've got about 2 minutes to go. You have a president that's been there forever, and that's unusual in higher education. How do you keep him?
He loves the challenge. He's so successful at what he does.
And we're talking about President...
We're talking about President Richard W. Schneider, retired Rear Admiral of the Coast Guard Reserves. It's in the military, they like to tease him because he's both an admiral and a general. He's a general in the Vermont State Militia. That's the Norwich University Corps of Cadets. Why does he stay? I mean, he loves the challenge, and he's done such incredible things for this university. And it's his 24th year.
Well, thank you so much, Daphne, for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
That is, we've been speaking with Daphne Larkin, Assistant Director of Communications. Tom, don't freak out. She's from Norwich University. And we've got that, I think, hopefully straight in terms of what's coming. Coming up, Bob Ney of Talk Media News. I want to ask him a couple of questions, basically about these Clinton emails, about Colin Powell being dragged into this mess, about Hillary's health issues that keep coming up in sort of websites and whether they're real or not. Also, Donald Trump reaching out to African Americans and basically saying to them, what do you have to lose by voting for me? Because he cites these statistics where they have sort of backtracked in their economic and personal security. Donald Trump and immigration seems to be, is he softening his position on immigration now that he has the nomination? And should have Obama gone to Louisiana sooner? Those are some of the things I want to ask. And then we have Rich Clark, director of Castleton Polling Institute. A lot of questions about polling and how they do polling. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, WDEV News Radio celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. You can go onto that website and hear our podcast anytime. As I said, coming up, Bob Ney, Talk Media News, Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute, and some time for your phone calls. This is Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on our line this morning Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Bob, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
I am fantastic. Let's start
nationally with Hillary Clinton. She has, there's been approximately 15,000 emails from the FBI that weren't previously turned over to the State Department. They have been turned over to the State Department. People are dying to see what's in those emails. Plus, there's the issue of contacts between the Clinton, between Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State and the State Department and the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
Where does this all go?
Well, it's not pretty, and on top of it, it's not good. Now, I know staunch defenders of Hillary Clinton, as staunch defenders of Trump, will defend him. They're saying, oh, we've been through these. No, this is brand new turf, brand new territory. None of this would have been disclosed, none of it, if it weren't for the fact that she's being forced to disclose it. The FBI had to piece things together because an initial server, you know, was deleted. And so now we're seeing the Clinton Foundation part of this, which frankly does way, way, way more damage than anybody could ever try to think about when we think about Benghazi and the committee, okay? So it's not the same old emails. Now, last night on Jimmy Kimmel, Hillary Clinton said, oh, these emails are boring. No, $32 million from the Prince of Bahrain, stern-run kingdom, went into the Clinton Foundation, and he didn't get a meeting through the regular process. $32 million went into the Clinton Foundation. A phone call was made. This is all documented. I'm not making this up, Mike. Phone call was made, and she met with him. Now, you know, nothing could be more clear-cut than, you know, the Prince of Bahrain gave $32 million to get a meeting. I mean, I can't make any other hide nor hair of it. Now, I'm not saying that they said, give us $32 million, we'll get a meeting. But as one who has been down this road, and I know what's going on here, you know, Hillary and Bill Clinton, as many people in politics in Washington, haven't learned from me and Jack Abramoff and Rob Blagojevich, the former governor of Illinois, and Jesse Jackson Jr. and Chaka Fetoh from Philadelphia. They just haven't learned a lesson. I don't care if these are common practices. That world should not exist anymore in D.C. I've been through it, and everybody else that I named.
But Hillary Clinton says Colin Powell did it, and Colin Powell says, whoa, wait a minute, no, I didn't.
You know, that one is so ridiculous in the sense that I don't care if Colin Powell did it. She had a deal with Barack Obama to not do this, and there was a different internet, and he didn't have a server in his house, and the email system didn't exist as it did. Now, the way Colin Powell operated doesn't make me feel real secure. But for Hillary Clinton, who decided to do this, and then a year later asks Colin Powell, he tells her in an email what he did, to actually say, well, Colin Powell did it, so what? I don't care if Abraham Lincoln did it, if there was an internet. She's always trying, and I've tried to give her a benefit of the doubt, but on this issue, she just always blames someone else. If you look at the history of this thing, nothing was classified. Yes, it was. Well, then I didn't delete anything. Yes, you did. I gave you all the emails. No, she didn't. And now, when she sits down with the FBI, well, Colin Powell did it. Does that make the FBI director say, oh, that's cool. Okay, bye-bye. Have a good day.
Why would she throw Colin Powell under the bus?
Because she's desperate to... Look, when I got in trouble, I did the same thing. I went on a trip to Scotland. Tom DeLay went before me on a trip to Scotland. When I got in trouble on the same trip to Scotland, the same type of trip he took, you know, I said to the FBI, Tom DeLay went on that trip. In other words, why didn't they indict Tom DeLay? Well, guess what? I'm the one that went to prison. I don't care what Tom DeLay did or didn't do on his trip. This is the same thing. You know, but I did the same thing. Well, Tom DeLay went on a trip. You know, so what's wrong with that? I use that as an example. What does the FBI care about Tom DeLay? They cared about me.
Let's keep on Hillary Clinton for a little bit. There are internet rumors abound about Hillary Clinton's health. Maybe it's campaign generated. Maybe it's Oppo campaign generated. But when you're splaining in a political situation, aren't you losing?
Yes, she just needs to have a foolproof, you know, medical statement or something, because if she wants to end this, look, I know when I hear, well, the vast right-wing conspiracy says this. No, I have heard this from people in the press corps. I have heard it from solid Democrats. I've heard everything, by the way. I don't even want to go into everything I've heard. I've heard it all of everything, of medical conditions she has. And by the way, not from vast right-wing conspiracies, but from people in the press corps. They've been talking about it. The press corps generated, Mike, this rumor more than anybody out there.
And what does she, Bob, what does she have to do to get rid of it? I mean, what would it have to be, a doctor's statement? What would end this?
If I were Hillary Clinton, I would get a foolproof, not like, I mean, Trump's doctor, you know, he's the healthiest guy on earth.
He's in phenomenal shape.
Yeah. Some kind of foolproof statement that, you know, she doesn't have any form of anything under the sun. You know, she didn't suffer hematoma or whatever from her fall. If she wants to end this. Now, some of it will dissipate because I think these emails are going to just continue on, brand new stuff coming out. But I will also note to you that, you know, it's going to take one good stumble or something. And Lord forbid, but if that happens, this whole thing's just going to go around like wildfire again.
Let's turn to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is reaching out to African Americans, and I thought it was an interesting line. Basically, he said to African Americans, what do you got to lose by going with me or voting Republican? Because look at your situation right now. It hasn't gotten any better under Democrats. Mm-hmm. Is it a good campaign strategy?
I think it is, but, you know, somebody said he's insensitive, and then I saw somebody on television who was African-American saying, you know, this is insulting, he's reaching out to us. Well, I don't think it's insulting. I had a horrifically Democratic district, and I used to say, hey, there's a lot of good Democrats, but guess what? They've ignored your city for 50 years because they take your vote for granted. I say it all the time. And you know what? People I said it to liked it because I didn't ignore them, you know. If Donald Trump stands there and says your unemployment rate is 56, the one guy came back and said, oh, no, it is not. It is 49. Oh, that's something to be happy with. I mean, it is what it is. And so I thought it was an okay strategy. Now, some friends of mine in Republican consulting circles say, why is he wasting his time? He's not going to get African-American votes. Well, you know what? He probably won't, but it still is a legitimate issue to raise if he really is sincere and wants to look at problems that people have.
It seems to me, Bob, that the economy, having security with your economic condition, having security with your public safety, doesn't see colors. I mean, people want economic security. They want public safety. They want to be safe. And that seems to be something that if he continues down that line, maybe he peels off not a large amount of African-American votes, but some.
Well, I think he's got nowhere to go but up because he's in dismal shape with African-Americans and Latinos. But I will tell you this, if he does peel off some of the voters, and if voter turnout is not high amongst Latino and African-American groups, he may peel enough off to beat Hillary Clinton. And then if he would become president and actually would do things, you know, for everybody, but in particular for those two groups, he could make a dynamic change in how those groups view the Republican Party. I mean, he really could if he would try. But he may peel enough people off, you know. This is going to be, I still have argued up and down, this is going to be such a tight election. I talked on purpose. I went to 10 normal people, I call them, earth creatures. They're not politicos, all right? They don't do media. And it's the same thing. They, 1 hour, are going to vote for Trump, and the next hour they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And they loathe both of them. So I think some of this polling goes back and forth. And it's not real accurate. I think it's going to be a close election. So if he peels off a certain amount of people, it could actually help him.
I'm getting confused on Trump's immigration policy.
So is he.
It seems to change from day to day. Is that a problem for him?
When I first heard that he was changing his policy yesterday, I thought, there you go. Your base is just going to run away from you, you know? And then I saw what he changed, and base won't run away from him. Look, the base that has supported him on this immigration issue has known from day one you can't deport everybody. It's illegal. They've known it. You can enforce and go after the MS-13 gangs. I remember they cut a poor young kid. He was on a one of his first dates. He was in Fairfax, Virginia. They cut his hands off as an initiation ritual. You know, these are bad players. These aren't little kids that are lost their way. They've been flown from Central America to Mexico to come across here with the drug barons is what they've done. And those people that are vicious murderers and horrible people need to be deported. That's not everybody, but they are here. So, you know, when he stayed to that, he's going to get rid of the real bad ones, and then we'll see after that the base doesn't leave him. He stayed with the wall. And that's where he started, with that wall. He cannot abandon that wall. He's got to keep on that wall. So I don't think he was hurt as bad as I thought he would be.
Let's turn to some of the surrogates that he's using. He's using Giuliani and Newt Gingrich a lot out there as surrogates. Oh, yes. Is that smart strategy?
It is smart for a couple of reasons. Those two men, you know, Giuliani and Newt Gingrich, are very well respected in the conservative community big time. Giuliani's sharp. He's smart. He was the mayor of 911. We all remember him. He's a great surrogate. Newt, I'm personally biased because I was around Newt 24/7 when I was in Congress, and the guy is quite amazing. Sometimes says things that makes some of the right go, But like the other week, Newt said, well, you know, that white people need to reach out and understand black people more. So Newt's a cerebral type of guy that really knows a lot about things. He really does. I mean, Newt's a walking book of information, so I think he's a great surrogate to have out there. But both of them help the base. Now, Rudy Giuliani helps beyond the base. A lot of people in this country do like Rudy Giuliani a lot.
One of the things that I find fascinating about politics and is that we require our president, whether it's George Bush or Barack Obama, to show up at events on natural disasters or other kinds of events. Actually showing up probably hinders the recovery operation more than it helps the recovery operation. But nonetheless, we require them. We criticized George Bush for flying over New Orleans because he didn't want to land and cause disruption. And there's enormous criticism of Barack Obama not leaving his vacation to go down to Louisiana to the floods. Was that a mistake?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, he attacked George Bush for flying over and waiting too late, and Barack Obama waited later than he did. Overall, though, I think you can't win on these things. You remember Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State who decided, they say, the Bush election?
Right.
Remember her from? She became a congresswoman. She was in Sweden on a family vacation when there was some hurricane or water problems in Florida, right? She was viciously attacked. I chaired the housing subcommittee. I ended up going down with her and went in a helicopter and went over sites, you know. And we did that because then people said, oh, she cares. She brought the chairman of the housing committee in. I hate this, but in this world, you know, you have to kind of physically be there. Now, Trump going down actually probably highlighted some awareness because, frankly, this flood was not getting the attention that Katrina got. And when Trump went down for the good or the bad, it did highlight it. But I kind of lay off of the presidents on this. You know, if they can't physically go down there and if it disrupts it, and Bush flew over, you know, they need to send the money. Make sure the money and the medical goods are going. Now, Obama's problem is, you know, he just kept on the golf course.
Right.
I mean,
the different pictures of being on the golf course and flooding just didn't jive right with the American.
That's right. It was constant, and, yeah, he needed to lay off of a day, get on the telephones. You know, that's the way it runs. And,
lastly, I want to turn to West Virginia because we've heard about a lot of the Republicans sort of jumping ship and supporting Hillary Clinton or not supporting Donald Trump. And what was interesting to me is there's a West Virginia gubernatorial race down there, and the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Jim Justice, says he can't support Hillary Clinton. Is that smart politics down there?
Yes. In fact, I did West Virginia Radio this morning, and a good buddy of mine is a big-time liberal that I do his show. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, what about your gubernatorial candidate? And he started whispering on air, and I said, excuse me, I can't hear you. So we were talking about, because I thought he'd dodge a little bit. I didn't think he'd go the full force of not supporting her, but the Clinton name in West Virginia is like airborne leprosy. And that's the Democratic. It's like airborne leprosy, some type of contagious disease. It is bad down there. She cannot get away from that coal miner comment.
And that's what I was going to ask. Is it the coal miner's comment that makes her not welcome down there?
Bill Clinton was gold down there. And the Clintons were really, really well, you know, in favor. That coal miner comment, she can't get away from it. And I think Bill Clinton went down and it was a disaster. I mean, Donald Trump is going to win West Virginia, and if the candidate for a governor wants to survive, he had to do what he did, or he literally won't survive that race. That's one state where the Clinton name is a complete disaster.
Bob, as always, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
That's Bob Ney from Talk Media News, and coming up is Rich Clark, the director of the Castleton Polling Institute. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have joining us this morning Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Mike.
If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. First off, Rich, can you explain what the Castleton Polling Institute is?
Sure. It's an independent research center within the University of Castleton University, and we conduct a number of public opinion polls. We help data collection for clients, and we have three goals, really. It's to teach. We have students come in and they learn about polling. They learn about empirical research in the social sciences. We engage in research to help give students an opportunity to engage in original research in the social sciences, and public service, so that we're helping state agencies, nonprofits, and other organizations with their data collection needs.
Let's you had recently, I think I read in the news that you had a fairly sizable grant that was awarded to you.
Yeah, I'm assuming the health-related thing for the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists.
Yes. What was that?
It's we're developing an app to collect data. There's a huge problem with data response today. Response rates, I don't have to tell you, and I'm sure you're aware, are just declining and declining. And so health professionals are looking for better ways to collect data on health, and so we're developing an app that people will download on their phones, and it'll ask a series of questions. Very short. It'll be low burden. It'll be fast response, so that we'll get the data a lot quicker than we do with traditional polls, and highly accurate, so that we'll be able to use a database and be able to assess the responses and make sure that they make sense based on past data.
And I want to get into that in a little while, you know, about the response rate with polling. But first off, how do you do a poll?
Well, I think my kids, when they were little, they had it down. It's, you know, daddy calls people and asks questions. We put all those answers together, and there you are. There's probably as much art as there is in science in terms of developing a survey instrument, always keeping in mind that we're developing questions that are not biased and that are not necessarily too difficult to understand. We write to a general population reading level and comprehension level. And then once we do that, we develop probability samples, meaning that we randomly sample from the general public we typically, for our polls, our political polls, we use telephone, contacting people by landline and cell phone. And we ask the questions in a standardized way. Our interviewers are trained to be non-biased and to ask questions in a certain manner, the way we ask them to ask them. And then we use some weighting to make sure that our data represent the public as best we can based on demographic figures.
We're speaking with Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Rich, I've noticed just recently there seems to be more sort of computer-generated polling than telephone polling, or there's an increasing amount of computer polling. Is one more accurate than the other?
Well, the accuracy is mixed right now. We see that there's a lot of the computer polling. A lot of the they're using samples that are generated through multiple different ways and asking questions online. And they've been very good. CBS has been working with the YouGov, and they've been very accurate. And a number of other organizations, such as GFK, have been doing this for a number of years with high rates of accuracy. But the problem is that we don't know when they don't work anymore. Where the polling industry is in just a time of flux. If we were talking in the 1990s, everybody used the same methods. We used random digit dial, we called households on landlines, and it was that simple. Today, we're all experimenting with new methods, and this comes back to the app that I was telling you about. We're even thinking about how do we get away from the traditional telephone polls and find better means for collecting data when the phone methods don't work anymore. So the computer app, the computer programs, and I cited two companies that are highly reputable. There's a lot that are not reputable that I would strongly urge people to avoid. Just look at, I go back to Michigan and the Democratic primaries there. The polls were so terrible, but everybody who knew anything about polling could have told you that two of those were going to be wildly off. And that's just the state of the game right now. We have so many different organizations participating in polling today that it's really hard to know who's going to be a reputable source and who's not.
One of the things that I find fascinating is that we have the changing demographics, the changing technology, as you pointed out, less landlines, more cell phones, other ways of doing. And you pointed out that the accuracy is something that we really need to pay attention to. And my question in computer polling, how do we know we get a good sample, a statistical sample, a good random sample in that? Is there a way?
Well, in a lot of those, they're not even worried about getting a random sample in that. It's based more on modeling after the fact than random sample. And there's a political scientist who has made the argument a number of years at the American Association for Public Opinion Research that none of us are getting probability samples anymore because our response rates are so low. And that being the case, we're all weighting the data and we're all doing a little bit of modeling to help make the sample look a lot more like the general population than it would have otherwise. So the internet ones, sometimes there are some that are worried about getting a random sample, like GFK, for example, but most of them are not, and they're just using modeling procedures to say, okay, the probability or the propensity of this individual actually voting is X based on all the demographic factors they have on him.
And that is the trick in polling, isn't it? The modeling aspect of polling?
Well, I wouldn't call it a trick, but it is very important that we get that right, yes.
Yeah, that was a wrong use of words. but the modeling is important of how you model, what the demographic data goes in there, how you weight various responses. That is sort of the guts of the trade.
Absolutely.
Response rates. Has caller ID ruined polling?
I remember when answering machines were new. Answering machines were our first barrier, but caller ID has hurt substantially, yes. Cell phones, there's a habit of people to not pick up a cell phone or not answer if they don't know who it is. But often they'll call back. So most of the phone centers were never equipped for incoming calls.
Mm-hmm.
We all have to be equipped for that now, for when they call, because they just might call us back and take the survey.
Well, as I've found out with my kids during their teenager years, during their college years, and even now, if you text them, they'll call back. But if you call them, they won't.
Yeah, we're not allowed to text them.
Recently in presidential primaries, and you mentioned it, and I was going to bring it up anyway, was the Michigan sort of fiasco.
Debacle.
In polling. They have been off. Even, international polling, like the Brexit vote, have been a little off, but not like Michigan. And we've been off in the 2014 governor's race as well. Why are we off?
Well, I think we over estimate the accuracy of polling quite often, because more often than not we're on. But it is a probability method, which means based on the probability samples we use, you should expect that one out of every 20 polls is going to be totally off mark. Just by chance. But in addition to that, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, but Michigan was way off. What
Michigan
happened?
Was way off because most of people were using the aggregated polls, and they aggregated two polling organizations into that. One of them that conducted the whole poll by robocalls on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, and can you explain why doing those on a weekend is bad?
Well, I would love to explain why doing them at all is bad, but let's go to the weekend there. Who's home on a Sunday afternoon doesn't quite reflect the voting population. And also, when you're doing the robo, you are not allowed to call cell phones, so it's only landline. So who's sitting at their home going to answer a landline on a Sunday afternoon is not likely to be representative of any voting population.
We're talking with Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I got a couple of questions. I did a poll for somebody that ran way too long, and what I found that was they wouldn't let me respond to except to the four answers that they had in the poll. So you couldn't really give your opinion in a opinion poll. And the other question is, what is the election that turned, I think it was in Britain, and they now have it as a benchmark when people won't admit who they're voting to because they don't want the stigma? Or do you believe you may have the same thing going on in our national election?
Well, thanks, Sam.
That second's a great question because people are raising that now. Trump himself is raising it from time to time, but it was originally called the Bradley effect in California, where people, it was actually the opposite, where they were telling you, "Oh, we would vote for Tom Bradley for governor," but because they didn't want to sound racist. And in fact, then they might go into the voting booth and not vote for him. Well, it turned out not to be a factor there, but it did happen in Virginia with Douglas Wilder, where he should have won by a larger margin based on the polls. And recalls and the exit polls showed us that was probably the case there. So is it possible that people will lie because of a stigma? People tell us that they're going to vote all the time and don't show up to vote because they don't want us to think badly of them when they're on the phone. Do I think that's going to be a large enough proportion of the voting population to skew the polls? I don't think so this year. But the the first question was...
Yeah, the length, that annoys me, the length sometimes of these books.
That annoys me as well, and it hurts the industry really badly, because when we tell people we're going to be on the phone with them 12 minutes, we're going to be on the phone with them 12 minutes, and those who kind of break that faith ruin it for the rest of us. You know, I think it's reasonable for the respondent to say, look, you told me 10 minutes. It's 10 minutes. And he also mentioned that, you know, sometimes his opinion didn't fit into the categories given, and that's usually a sign of a poorly designed poll, because our categories need to be exhaustive and exclusive so that the majority of opinions that are out there will fit into a category, and that they won't fit into more than one.
Rich, can you hold on for a second? I've got a lot of questions here for you, so can you hold just a few?
Happy to be here, yeah.
We're speaking with Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. When we come back, we have more questions for him. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. On the phone with us today is Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. If you wish to join our conversation, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Rich, I want to ask this question. How do polls catch quick turns in public sentiment, or are they always sort of destined to be backward looking?
Well, I think the only way that the catch the quick turns are those who are doing large volume nightly. And Gallup had been doing this, you know, they've laid off a lot of their election polling, but they always used to do, about 1,500 or more a night, and use a rolling sample, so that they used kind of like three-night sample every release. So every day you'd be looking at the past three nights. So you can see changes, subtle changes in the campaign dynamics on a regular basis. For you know, small shops like ours, we're getting a snapshot that's always going to be a little bit backward looking, seeing where the public is at a given moment, and it would take us, you know, another week or two to see where things have turned.
You mentioned Gallup, and Gallup said it's gotten out of the presidential polling.
The horse race, anyways.
Yeah, why that?
Well, I think part of it, well, first off, you know, polls did fabulous in 2012, and the one kind of outlier, Gallup, missed the mark there. You know, they had Romney, and they stuck with Romney in their projections, and they had to reassess what they were doing. And so I think you know, they've taken a look at their strength, and their strength is in measuring public opinion broadly, and they didn't want to have to constantly revise their estimates for a likely voter model.
Recently you did a poll for VPR, and the interesting results, to me at least, and I wrote a sort of a column on this, and I should have mentioned you, Rich, in that column. I apologize.
All's forgiven.
But that the two most liked candidates won their primary, Sue mm-hmm. Minter and Phil Scott. Did that surprise you?
No, not at all. The favorability, especially in a primary, when you don't have the party queue, you know, when you go with, you may have good feelings about one candidate, but if you're not, if that's not of your party, you know, it makes a hard, you got to make a hard choice about going for them. But when you're looking at the primary race and you don't have party queues, all you have to go on is kind of that feeling, good feeling, bad feeling. I think the favorability ratings are a pretty good judge of it.
Also, in the spring or late fall last year, you had done a poll which showed the number one concern were economic concerns. Mm-hmm. Now, when you sort of combine that with budget and spending, it's almost half of the public have that as their number one issue. Do you think that's changed at all, or you feel pretty confident that's probably going to be what, if you poll that again today, that's going to be the exact same?
And we did. It was in the more recent VPR poll, too, where economics loomed largest as the most important problem. I think that is you know, I don't know what happened with education, but education concerns kind of fell off the map, we noticed, in the more recent poll, and economics loomed large. So I would expect that's going to be a topic, and I think, you know, probably some of our gubernatorial candidates realize that as well if they're doing some internal polling, because it certainly was a topic in the debate, and it's going to continue to be.
In the Douglas administration, there was extensive use of polling. Is that sort of the new norm for candidates?
I think so. I think I just heard this, and I could be wrong, but the Donald Trump's campaign manager, the first pollster to actually hold the position of campaign manager for a presidential candidate. So, yay for pollsters. We're moving up the food chain a bit, you know. It's not just a case of, you know, trying to find out where the public is going and then changing your positions to match that. I think the campaigns are sophisticated in finding out who are their target audiences, who are they reaching, and who do they still need to make their case to. So I have a less cynical view of candidates using polling than I think a lot of people do, because I think it helps them stay in touch with the people they're trying to represent.
You mentioned the VPR poll just recently that the Castleton Polling Institute performed. What, anything in there surprise you?
No, actually, you know, I always say that the best poll is when I'm not surprised. If I'm surprised, I always got to go back and look and say, what did I do wrong? I think it came out. I'm trying to think if there was anything that kind of shook me any. Sorry, giving you the wrong answer to the question.
No, not at all.
I don't think there were any surprises there.
You know, the likability factor on some of the candidates, the name recognition factor on some of the candidates.
Okay, and there is one. And actually, I'm less surprised than most people were surprised by the lieutenant governor's race, the fact that Shep Smith and Zuckerman had about equal name recognition. And people said, well, you know, Smith has been Speaker of the House. How could that be? And I think it speaks a lot to how closely people pay attention to the state legislature.
And that actually, Rich, didn't surprise me because, ironically, Lieutenant Governor, Speaker of the House, those positions don't have high name recognition as compared to Governor, or Bernie Sanders, or Senator Leahy, or Peter Welch. Those are the four that have the highest name, traditionally have had the highest name recognition.
Right.
One of the things that I just wanted to ask, what's up next? Will you be active during the upcoming Vermont political races?
Well, yeah, the VPR is going to have another poll with us before the general election. And other than that, we're quite busy with some of our other client work and the project we spoke of at the outset of this program.
Just, I got about a minute left here before I have to break. But students, what do they get out of this?
Well, we have students come in and they're working with me and they're learning the craft. They're learning the nature of empirical research in social sciences. So that most of our all of our interviewers are paid. Most of them are not students, but the students who come in and work, they get to see. Essentially how it's the sausage making. They get to see the process and learn a little more about polling so that they can be intelligent consumers of polling data as they go forth, or perhaps even pollsters themselves.
Hey, Rich, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you, Mike.
Rich Clark, director of Castleton Polling Institute. When we come up, we'll sort of wrap up the day. There won't be any time for open mic. Apologize for that. We got a little bit behind because we had interesting people today. So it is something that happens here. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Tom, we need another hour. It just flies by. I did want to let you know that as I started out with the program this morning, I have contacted the campaigns of Sue Minter and Phil Scott shortly after their primary victories. regarding their willingness to participate in this year's Tunbridge Fair debate, and I must say that it is not going well. Sue Minter never got back to us, and the Phil Scott campaign put conditions on the debate that I quickly rejected. So I know we've gotten some calls on this. I will continue. I haven't given up. I will continue to pursue this debate. But right now it looks a little bleak. But we've had this rich history at the Tunbridge Fair of having this debate. I want to continue this debate. I want to find ways to do that without the conditions that have been imposed on it and with candidates getting back to us in terms of their willingness to participate. So we'll still continue to work on this. The reasons I pointed out, it'll take too long right now to point out the reasons why I rejected the conditions of the Phil Scott campaign, but they're valid reasons for the state of Vermont. I want to thank our guest today, Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor. Also, Daphne Larkin, assistant director of communications at Norwich University. Bob Ney, who extended his time with us today, and Rich Clark, director of the Castleton Polling Institute. And, of course, all of you. Thank you for listening. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Celebrating the future. That's what we're doing at WDEV News Radio. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond, and of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.